This morning, Oliver's been eating toast with peanut butter and honey and apples and grapes for breakfast. And he sat down at the breakfast table, was eating for a couple of minutes, then he stopped and he goes, "This is boring." I don't think he was talking about the food, but he was just like he was just feeling ennui or something. He was.
Oh man, that's sad. Like the first time that you saw him like actually figure out what boredom is and be like, "Oh no."
Yeah, exactly. It's like a little glimpse into him as a teenager, just like,
there's nothing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty funny. I mean, yeah, you're gonna have to start peeling his grapes or something now,
Exactly.
I
There's a conversation, peeling grapes.
Ugh, have you ever had to do that?
Yeah, I put it on a menu.
Good man.
We had an Arctic char dish with peeled grapes on it about a year ago or so. Yeah.
Yeah, fun.
It's interesting how different, like, it's not like one technique for peeling grapes works for all grapes. There's some.
Yeah.
We got in and it's like you can literally just peel the raw grape fairly easily. And then some we had to blanch and some we had to like we would like partially freeze. Like so
Oh,
this
yeah.
the outside was really hard and some of them like just were so resistant to any kind of clean peeling. They were
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, and there's like grapes that you just straight up couldn't peel, like Concords or something like that.
Right. Yeah,
If you tried
totally.
to
Yeah.
peel them, they would just juice all over
Yeah.
the place.
Yes.
Yeah. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my friend Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Pretty good.
Good man. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Alan, do we have any follow-up?
Not for me. Oh, I did try
Okay.
one thing we were talking about. Were we talking about this in Folidays about the unique Halloween pumpkin pie, something to distinguish it from Thanksgiving pumpkin pie?
Right.
I did
Yeah.
make a version of this
Okay.
and used the we actually had pumpkin seed flour in our pantry, and it was made from
Oh, cool.
the Styrian pumpkin seeds that have a really dark green color.
Yeah.
So I used that in place of almond flour in a pâte sucrée recipe, and then made my kabocha squash custard. Sorry, blind baked that, and so it
Nice.
came out with like a little bit, like a light green color. Looked kind of
Yeah.
cool. And then did my kabocha squash puree filling, custard filling, and then bruleed the top, and it was pretty
I
good.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it could be bad.
I've had a pastry instructor at Nate taste it, and I
Oh
was
yeah.
particularly interested in the quality of my crust because that's something I'm working on.
Right.
And
Although a
he,
little different if you're using pumpkin seed flour, like.
yeah, well, actually, his comment was that the crust was okay, but that the pumpkin seed flour, even though it looked kind of cool, like it didn't actually bring much flavor to the party. And so he said, like, if you whatever it's your dish and you need to have the vision for it, but like if you really wanted to press a flavor, you could like use grand pecan or sorry ground pecans, and you could use brown butter and stuff like that. So
Right,
that was an
yeah.
interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm sure that there's also a way to like, I mean, I think it's funny when chefs talk to chefs about what the like about their food, and everyone has to preface everything with like, okay, well, you know, it's your dish and you should do what you want. But you know, like I don't know, it's weird. It seems like that should sort of be like
A given.
that should go without saying or something like that. And then it's
Right.
clear that if you're going to say something, if someone's requesting like you know, like feedback from you about a dish, like they're looking for your opinion about it. But like I don't know, I do think that like those conversations do tend to wind up like in the realm of opinion where someone is like offering up an idea for like a flavor that they think would be better in the dish.
Right.
And like that to me seems weird. Like I think I probably used to do that a lot, but that seems like a weird approach to me. Like clearly if you wanted the flavor of pecan in your dish, then right. That's something that, you know, and so it's kind of counterproductive to be like, well, I think it would be good with pecans or something like that. Like that's just kind of, I don't know, like it seems a little.
just to rush to his defense. I think that his only comment was like, it looks cool. The quality, like the texture is good. I don't taste pumpkin seeds. And then I said, yeah, I wonder if, I think that my response was, yeah, maybe it's not even the best thing to use in a crust. Maybe you could use something else. And then he offered pecan, but like,
right.
There's probably ways to press the flavor better. Like if you, it can probably,
well, this is what I was thinking. Like if I was going to be offering suggestions, it would be how do I get the pumpkin flavor out of the pumpkin seeds or like make the crust taste like pumpkin seeds more, you know, like if the flavor is kind of lacking in that department and the idea is to bring more pumpkin flavor by also having the flavor of the seeds, then how can I get that flavor to be more prominent in the crust, you know, rather than swapping it out for something else or whatever.
Okay. Well, I'll go back to him with that today and say, here's some advice on how to give advice.
Because if he listens to the show, then he can maybe send me a message and be like, look, buddy.
But no, that's all that I had regarding past conversations.
Yeah. did you see that friend of the show, Erica, sent us some pictures on Instagram of a pie? I don't know. She was listening to the Fall It Is episode and thinking about the jack-o'-lantern pie. Mm-hmm. And then this is a pie that a student of hers baked in a class that she was doing. And it's like... the crust, the top crust is like perforated to look like a face, but then after it was baked, it looks like it still looks like a face. It just looks like a very scary face.
Oh, really?
And
I'm kind of sad
that you haven't seen it because it's pretty amazing. I'll ask her for permission for us to be able to post it on our Instagram because, man, I don't know how she'll feel about it because obviously it was like a student's pie. Maybe she would need to get that person's permission or something. But, man, it looks like a pretty bloody smile. It looks like a perfect Halloween pie, honestly.
I hate those like those really fancy plating like Instagram feeds where they just show like ridiculously ornate plates that could never be served in a restaurant. But when they have, sorry, you know what I mean, right? Like
we're
like
sort whatever, of like, I mean, I think there's probably a way to serve them in a restaurant, but
I don't know, I've seen some pretty silly ones.
All right.
But they have ones where it's like extremely intricate, complex, raw pastry work, like a lattice on top of a pie or whatever, but unbaked. Yeah, of course it looks perfect and clean, but like you have to see it after it's baked. Otherwise it's completely meaningless because if you didn't make the dough right, then it's going to deform as it bakes. And I don't know. I always think it's silly.
I agree. Well, and it's funny too, because I've been watching a bunch of like, feeds about food photography and like, that's a whole, like, there's just all these techniques that have nothing to do with food and, you know, like, I mean, they have to do with making things look like their food, but they aren't really food at all. Mm-hmm. And like, there's a lot of substitution types of things like that, that you use and, you know, things to and techniques to make things look cooked when they're not.
Yes.
And so you don't have to cook them and deform them, but you can put a little brown on them by hitting them with a torch and, or something, you know, like,
That's what there was someone at that Cooks Camp conference that works in food styling. And they were like, half the stuff you see on Instagram is like on professional feeds. Like you can't make that food, like you can't and make it edible. That's an interesting conversation. I'd love to know more.
Maybe we should have that conversation at some point. I don't know. Like it would require more research probably on both of our parts to.
Yeah. But we were talking about someone had suggested the like food porn genre and we started talking about how like
listener Greg suggested that, I believe.
Right. we were talking about how like our, the way that we interact with food in quotation marks primarily now is through images online instead of through sharing meals with people. And mm-hmm. I feel like that's like plugged into the conversation about food styling and how fake everything is.
Yeah, totally. Those two things together are definitely an episode. Okay. Watch out for that one, people.
That'll be in a few years when our full-time job is this podcast and we have an entire week to do research, 2 weeks to do research and actually form content and give it structure.
Oh, man.
But one other thing, speaking of Erica and speaking of our Halloween food ideas, I think it was last year, she made pumpkin bread and she, in before its final proof, she must have used like wire or like twine or something to, oh no, sorry, maybe she, I actually don't know how she did it. I meant to look into this. Maybe she, maybe it was, had some kind of wire or twine on it when it went in the oven. I'm not sure, but it had, the vertical, like longitudinal, creases that a pumpkin has. And she stuck a pumpkin stem in the top of it. So it looked like a little, it was pumpkin bread that looked just like a little pumpkin. It was so adorable.
What a great idea.
That could be your Halloween bread course.
Yeah, totally. Man. Okay, for next year, we have to have an actual Halloween menu. Actually plan it out and actually have a good idea like that for every course.
When
the
I,
way we went about it was totally backwards.
Yeah. When I write something and then realize that I haven't really come to the right to any conclusion or whatever, I was just like retitle it instead of like being Halloween cuisine. I say towards a Halloween cuisine. So it's like, we're not there, but we're taking a step there.
Yeah. A study in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, what topic are we going to butcher tonight, Alan?
Okay. No, this one's going to be good. The last one was fine too.
That's good.
Okay. Shale, what month is it right now?
Well, right now,
yeah, at this moment,
it's kind of a confusing question because if you're listening to this, it's probably November, but if you're recording it, it's October.
You're close. It is October, but it's actually October 1992.
Whoa.
We've traveled back in time 30 years.
We're in the hot tub.
And Brian Mulroney is our prime minister. And George Bush Sr. is the American president for a little while longer.
Right.
The Blue Jays are in the World Series.
What? That's
they've
not
captured,
possible.
They've captured the hearts of all Canadians.
I'm a Canadian and I don't... so far that hasn't happened.
But. You weren't into it?
I don't think I was.
Oh, really?
Hmm. No, we're there, Alan. We're there. So no, I'm not into it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. And Baby Got Back got released recently.
Why are we here? It sounds like torture.
Chris Cross is topping the charts. He's gonna make you jump.
there's got to be one redeeming thing. Tell me one good thing that happened in 1992, Alan. Did some Canadian culinary team do something extraordinary?
Right, yeah, and in Frankfurt, Germany, the Canadian national culinary team won best overall at the Culinary Olympics, the ICA Culinary Olympics. That's what we're going to talk about, sort of.
That is something good that happened.
Yeah.
What's ICA?
ICA, so that's an acronym, IKA. It's German. It's like International Kochkunst Ausstellung or something. It means like international culinary exhibition. And for a lot of people, the Culinary Olympics are the Bocuse d'Or in France, but that happens every 2 years. And so technically it can't be called Olympics because it's not separated by an Olympiad, which is 4 years.
Right.
So the ICA Culinary Olympics, they get it on a technicality. They are considered the Culinary Olympics. And yeah, they've happened every 4 years since the year 1900, usually in Frankfurt, but I think it's moved a bit, like it's been in Stuttgart and Berlin and stuff. But
cool.
And to be honest about it, like the entire cooking competition scene, I know very little about. Like I've done one cooking competition in my entire life and it was just at culinary school.
Yeah, me too.
But there's chefs who like this is what they do, and they operate at a very high level, and so at these events, the teams, I think they compete in several categories, and you can win medals in different categories. But then through a fairly complicated point system, like there is like an overall winner that's announced at the end of the event. So, like in 2020, I know Norway won. I don't know very much about these, but anyways, the only time that Canada has won best overall was in 1992. And Nate, the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, had some pretty strong connections to that team. Like there's a member of that team named Clayton Folkers, who became a pastry instructor at Nate for many, many years and just retired this year. So what we're actually talking about today is that there was this is kind of a deep cut. This is a deep dive.
It's a little bit of it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit convoluted, but yeah, we'll get there.
To commemorate the 30-year anniversary of this victory, Nate hosted a dinner in which my class was tasked with essentially recreating the 3-course menu that Team Canada served in 1992. And we're going to talk about that and how we did that. And you're going to offer some ideas on how you might have gone at it. Is that the plan?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I think it'll be more interesting since you've already done this and gone through it all and seen the result of what you did for it. I think it might be, and hopefully this won't make it like, you know, way too long a conversation, but yeah, I think it would be fun for like me to offer up what I would do first.
Yes,
and then for you to poke holes in it.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, well, Shale, did you think of this or whatever? Yeah. So when you were tasked with recreating it, it wasn't like to try and recreate it like verbatim, right? It was like to reinterpret it Yeah. Okay.
So that's what we were given a small package that was used in the competition that had it had photos of the plates. It had all the descriptive copy of the dishes, and it had some kind of, I'd say, I don't know if how they didn't seem especially detailed to me, but some kind of high level recipes, and information like that. And we were told, you don't need to make this exactly. You can make it your own. You can make it more contemporary. You can whatever, just like, this is your starting point. Initially I was like, no, we are making these plates. They're going to look exactly like they did in 1992. But then,
oh my God. Did you say that after you saw the pictures or
yes,
before?
Oh yes, absolutely. I was like, oh yes, this is what we're making. It has to look like this. We're going to play the Beastie Boys and Boys to Men, and we're going to make the plates look like this. But anyways, that didn't actually kind of worked out with the first course. But then the circumstances conspired. It didn't work out for the others.
Circumstances like the pictures of the plates in the document look horrible, you mean? Or
no, I don't think they look
mostly horrible. My quibbles are with the dessert plate.
It's
gotta say.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Oh my
to put
God,
this image
it
up.
Looks, oh, it's visually very challenging. It looks like a, I don't know,
an owl.
Look,
we need to hold on. We're getting
no. Why don't we talk about it when we get to dessert?
Yeah, let me. Okay. I'm just gonna read. I'm gonna read the kind of romantic copy that they provided. For sure, the menu. Okay. So 3 courses. Oh, and sorry the dessert course, the 3rd course was actually, that was executed by a pastry class, not by my class. So I wasn't involved in its production. I know a little bit about how they did it and what changes they made, but I wasn't really on the ground there.
You didn't design that dish and
you didn't
have anything really to do with having to make it.
Yeah. But here's our menu. So our 3 courses we have. Marinated British Columbia salmon is presented warm in a crepe with a reduction of cream and cognac and pink peppercorns. Mixed leaves drizzled with a lemon vinaigrette garnish the appetizer. That's our 1st course.
Okay.
Next, An entree of applewood smoked pheasant breast is lined with sweet basil and rosemary and served in its glass with sun-dried currants. Vegetable accompaniments include potato lasagna, baby leeks, Savoy cabbage, and carrots. For dessert, a Manitoba wild rice croquant is filled with rhubarb butter and garnished with a chocolate owl. Blackberry coulis completes the presentation. There you are.
So, this chocolate owl.
Should we not start with the appetizer?
Oh my God, Alan. It looks like a 5-year-old's cartoon drawing of what an owl might look like. I'm serious. Like I'm not trying to hurt anyone's feelings, and I doubt that anyone who traced one of these owls is going to listen to this podcast. But man, like, it just, yeah, like, you take some, like, I don't know, I understand the idea, but when you see the picture of it, which, I don't know, is it possible that we're allowed to post any of these pictures on our Instagram, Alan, or is that?
I don't see why not.
Okay. Because I would love to post a picture of this owl on our Instagram. But I mean, like, it just, you know, it looks like, I mean, they came up with an idea for what, like, maybe a cartoon owl could look like. But then it's just, like, executed by hand. And I mean, like, obviously it's not an easy thing to do. And then, but, like, it's also a difficult thing to make look good. And I think it does not look good. Like, I think it looks childish, amateurish. Like, it looks like, yeah, it looks, I don't know, and not in a fun way. Like, yeah, I'm shocked that they got to the point where they were willing to take a picture of this plate and send it away as, like, their idea for what they were going to serve at the Culinary Olympics. I'm, like, shocked.
It's interesting. Like, I think that besides it being 30 years ago. Okay, so two points.
Right.
It being 30 years ago, it's really surprising how different our idea of fine dining is now than it was 30 years ago. You look at, like,
it's crazy.
Some of the plates that Marco Pierre White made in the late 90s, or sorry, the late 80s, like, would be laughed out of a restaurant now. But it was just a completely different scene. And at the time, a lot of that was new. And anyway, so that's one part, the time. The other thing, even though I don't know very much about it, I do think that probably the artistic sensibility in the competition scene is a lot different than yours or mine, to be honest. Like, I was quickly looking at some videos and stuff from more recent Culinary Olympics. And there's a lot of, I think as a way to display as much technique and finesse as possible, there's a lot of effort put into the, like, carving and molding and shaping and the kind of, like, plastic arts side of food.
Totally.
And so I think this kind of plays to that, where, like, this is, like, exceptional, like, exceptional chocolate technique. It's handmade without a stencil. But yeah, I understand, like, it looks tacky to you, right?
Well, it's not just that, though. Okay. So I mean, it does look tacky to me. And that's just sort of, like, the first impression kind of thing, right? Is that I see it and I'm like, oh my God, it looks hilarious. And, you know, yeah, it looks like it's from the 90s, which, that makes sense, right? but like, to me, and clearly, yeah, like you said previously, like in your first point, the sensibilities about what, like, artistically or aesthetically made sense for food in the 90s is very different from what makes sense aesthetically for food now. Like, I understand both of your points, but this to me seems like a bad way to show that technique. Like, this to me looks like you know, like, if you want to show something that looks like good technique, well practiced, well architected. This, like, freehanding a line of chocolate that's piped onto a flat surface just doesn't really seem like it's not culinary technique. It's like drawing with a pencil technique or something. And like, yeah, to me, it doesn't really, I don't know. I suppose if you like put 100 of them side by side and they all looked exactly the same and they all had the same little like kind of messy bits where the chocolate has to like go back over itself and things like that. Like,
right, yeah.
I mean, maybe that would show something about the repeatability of technique in this situation, but to me, it's not a good showcase for like the technique of working with chocolate. Just like, just taking some tempered chocolate and drawing an owl on a flat surface and standing it up it's not impressive.
I
know that in the 90s, there was way better chocolate technique than this. Like, this was not the cutting edge of chocolate technique in the 90s. Like, you know, there was, you know, like all of those things, like, you know, using acetate to make designs and like using different combs and, you know, like all of that stuff existed in the 90s. This just seems like amateurish to me. I don't know.
They would have, they served this, these three courses to 120 people. So there was that element of like, executing something consistently that's clearly like, free, hand piped. So that was an element of it. I don't know. I actually, like, to me, it's just, the presentation is a little bit tacky and clearly dated, but I think that it shows fantastic technique. Like, it's piping technique, and you can call it drawing or whatever, but that's what it is. And it requires skill. So
I don't know. I don't agree. This doesn't look like it requires skill to me. It looks like we have to come up with a design that somebody who's bad at this can repeat.
Chill, you are going to pipe this chocolate owl, and we are going to take a picture of it, and we're going to put it on Instagram side by side with this one.
Okay, sounds good.
And you will eat crow. Just kidding. I'm just kidding.
I mean, I'm not a chocolate piper by day, but but I feel like I could pipe this chocolate owl. That's the problem. You know, like I look at this and I'm like, yeah, I mean, I could take two cracks at that and do just as good a job probably.
That's not fair. It's like when someone goes to a restaurant and eats a dish and says, well, I could make that at home. Like, yeah, you probably could make that for yourself and your girlfriend at home one time and it would be good. But can you make it?
You don't think I could pipe this?
Can you make it 120 times in an hour? Like,
actually, what's scaring me here, Alan, is it's sounding to me like you don't think you could pipe this owl. It sounds like you think that this would be difficult. But I can't picture that.
It's funny because one of the changes that was made in the final presentation of the 2022 version of this was that they had to change the structure, like the design of the owl, because the lines of piped chocolate that are standing vertical, like, are so delicate, they couldn't get it to consistently stay together.
Yeah, so they made a more, that's not surprising.
So they made a more rigid, like a more, more filled out and more rigid, design. So besides the actual lines and shaping and all that, like, the structure is very delicate, and I haven't worked with chocolate very much, but like, if I'm watching pastry chefs try to do it and they're having difficulty, then I think that I probably would I probably couldn't do it. I said it.
Okay,
I can draw. I can draw this owl with a pen.
Okay, so and then this is like sort of my exact point is that this looks like a difficult to do repeatedly so that each one actually looks good. I mean, if you think that it looks good, which I don't really, but like difficult to do repeatedly so that each one looks good, and then not really showing, aside from like the hand piping technique that you're talking about, it's not really showing much like imagination for the technique. I'm not quite sure what they, so like there's a couple areas on this owl where they filled in some parts with what looks like maybe it's white chocolate or something like that. If the whole owl is chocolate,
right,
then maybe the eyes have a little bit of white chocolate in them so that you can have like the pupils, and then the wings and the feet have a little bit of white chocolate in them as well. For structure. But like, it doesn't really feel like there's much technique involved, you know, like there's a single technique. Whereas I, you know, like chocolate work involves like so many different types of techniques that you can use to like shape and, I don't know, make things look more, yeah, aesthetically clean. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This has a very aesthetically messy look to it to me. And I just don't really understand why you would take that approach. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Was there something about owls that was like a part of the competition description or something? Or was it like,
not that I know of,
like it's a Canadian thing or something?
I guess is, I don't know if there is, is it totally speculation? There's like, it's Manitoba wild rice is like Manitoba's bird, an owl.
Oh yeah. I don't know.
I bet it is.
Good question. I was actually, when I first looked at it, I was like, is this an angry pheasant? Because there's the like pheasant on the main course. Yeah. And I was like, the dessert comes with like an angry looking pheasant on it to be like, you just ate me.
And we were joking, the mascot of Nate is a kind of owl called an ook.
Oh
yeah.
Anyways, called Luke?
Ook. I think.
Oh, ook. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. Ook is, I think, I can't remember which indigenous language, but I think it's the word for snowy owl, I think.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Don't quote me on that.
Fair.
I should know though.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll know by next episode. And it'll be
a... Stay tuned. In 2 weeks, yeah, exactly. You'll find out.
We can move on. I didn't mean for that to take so long. I honestly didn't think you were going to be as excited to defend it as I thought you were. It looks kind of silly to me, and I feel like I would have taken a different tack, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyway, we started by talking about dessert, which is not what we wanted to do.
I tried to keep us on track because you started on the owl and then I was like, wait a minute, let's read the menu first. And then you went right back to the owl. Should we do the
appetizer? I think it was entirely my fault, but, well, actually just before we really get into it, mm-hmm. I just want to say that I think that it's pretty amazing that like this documentation still exists.
Yeah.
Like I'm not like an investigative reporter or anything like that. I don't really know, like, I don't have a solid idea of like, you know, archival documentation, but like, I'm pretty amazed that like this document that they sent as it looks like this is I guess they're sort of like, what would you call it? Treatment of what their competitive dinner is going to be.
Yes.
So that somebody on the competition board or on the judging team can look at the documentation ahead of time and see what they're going to be served by Team Canada.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm just it's so cool to be able to look at this and look at the pictures and revisit what they had in mind and what they presented for like their, to the competition. And,
yeah.
And like, you know, it's quite granular too. Like you said, like the recipes aren't super fleshed out. And there's definitely a few components that are on the dishes that don't really have actual recipes here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But like there's basically a recipe for each of the dishes and there's an ingredients list with costing breakdowns and everything for each of the dishes. And it's just really cool to be able to go through and be like, you can sort of, you know, just like you can do a bit of a historical reconstruction in your mind of, you know, like what the procurement was like and what it was like to try to go to this competition and to like price everything out and figure out what you were going to put on the plates. And it's just like, it's been fun looking at it and just sort of like imagining what it would have been like to go to Germany and try and present this.
Yeah, totally. That's a great point. Like I imagine that this was a package that would have been faxed to the organizers of the competition. But yeah, somewhere like along the line, it got digitized and you're right. The detail is pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it seems like the kind of thing that must have at some point wound up like in a filing box or something somewhere. And then at some point, like maybe for the 20th anniversary or something, someone dug out the filing box and was like, oh, what do we have about this?
Right.
You know, like, yeah. Can we, you know, do we remember what we cooked for this dinner and stuff like that, and found this and digitized it or whatever. And yeah, it's just, I'm pretty excited to be able to look through it. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. First course, appetizer course. Oh, and the other thing that I wanted to say is, I don't know if you know, Alan, but I would be shocked to find out that like dinners for these types of competitions and for the Culinary Olympics in specific, I'd be shocked if it's still a 3-course menu for like a dinner presentation.
I think it is.
Really?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I was trying to read through the different categories. I think that the kind of like flagship, because they do a few different kinds of services, like there's a cold platter presentation and whatever, but right. I believe that the kind of like flagship service is still a 3-course dinner, I think.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah. Do you mean that?
That's interesting.
You thought it would be longer? Or sorry, more?
Yeah, I imagine that it would just like, yeah, the number of courses would go up. Like, mm-hmm. you know, not that it would be like 25 courses or something like that, but that, you know, mm-hmm. that it might be 5 by now or something like that, because I don't know, just because of the way fine dining has changed.
Right.
It's much more like in real world, like fine dining restaurants, it's much more like concentrated, small presentations of yes. like singular ideas, you know? And so doing, you know, like giving a good representation of all the technique that you can do and stuff in 3 courses is just, I think, like a bit trickier to make it seem contemporary mm-hmm. to try and do it in 3 courses.
But. Yeah, totally. And when you only have the 3 courses for the principal plate, like it kind of, not really, but it kind of constrains you to the like protein, starch, veg kind of structure, because like to make the meal feel rounded, you have to put all of those elements on the plate, whereas more extensive, like more courses, you could kind of parse those out and you could have one dish that's focused on potatoes and one that's focused on meat and stuff like that. Yeah,
like you could have a veg plate or a meat plate with veg or something, but not necessarily have to put a starch on it, because it doesn't necessarily need to be a full meal in that like one course or whatever.
So yeah, I don't know if it's just like they've had this structure for 120 years and that's what they do, or I don't know.
And they refuse to change it or
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So appetizer. So you kind of read the description for it already. Like further down on the on the menu portion. So I'm assuming this is like probably what they had on the menu text for the judges. There's a description of it that's a little bit shorter than the description that you read.
Yeah, that's right. It just says marinated salmon crepes with mesclun salad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So nice, quick sort of like menu blurb. And do you want me to tell you what I would have done for this dish?
Sure. We can say like from the recipes that they provided for this, the salmon treatment, they basically just marinated it with salt, brown sugar, a little bit of allspice and a little bit of black pepper. And that's it. After that, it was just sliced. The crepes were very straightforward, like a very traditional crepe, flour, milk, egg, butter. There was a lemon vinaigrette to toss the greens in that had mustard and shallot and garlic in it. And they had that a cream reduction drizzled over the salmon. And the greens contained dill and Spanish onion as well. But otherwise, so yeah, that's what they had done. So what would you do?
I mean, I love this idea. When I'm looking at the presentation, like the picture of the presentation on here, there's a couple of things that I would probably change just to make it feel a little bit more modern. So like the idea of the dish is sort of that it's like the salmon is sandwiched between 2 crepes that are just laid flat on top of each other. So it's a circle.
Yep.
With 1 crepe on the bottom and then salmon covering that crepe. And then they drizzle the cream sauce that's flavored with pink peppercorn and pepper It's like basically a cream reduction. So it's a little, it's just cream, but it's a little bit thicker, like double cream, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then they put another crepe on top of it. But then the second crepe, they fold back one corner of it so that you can see the salmon and the cream sauce sort of like in between.
Yeah.
Which I think is intended to give it a little bit of height. And so you can see the salmon and get a little bit of the color of the salmon and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that I probably wouldn't serve it with like the salmon sandwiched between two crepes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd probably do something different with the presentation with the crepes. Like, I don't know. I don't really have a solid idea of what I do. I know that, you know, I can think of lots of like more modern plating techniques that would give it like a little bit more dimension, things that would make it look more contemporary. Mm-hmm. You know, like you might do something now where you take the salmon and mold it somehow into like a circle or a sphere or something like that, and then have the sauce like be inside of it and then wrap the crepe around it in a way or something to give the plate a little bit more of an architectural look or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of plating techniques, but like generally for a plate that's designed in the 90s, I think it looks pretty good, just not very contemporary.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would definitely do something with the plating to give it more white space and make it look a little more architectural. Yes. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, if I was designing this dish now, I would not be using mescaline salad.
Right.
Like, yep. You know, like, that seemed like something that was, like, kind of elevated. And probably you could get really elevated versions of, like, mescaline greens. And you still can. Like, if you know, you can get really great, like, mescaline mix that's like, you know, beautiful and organically grown. But mescaline is like so pervasive now because it turned into a fad in the 90s and the 2000s, and it's just like a really horrible version of what it could used to be. And so I even if you made like a really nice mescaline mix now, it would still be perceived in the way that like
this,
you know?
Is something I was actually talking about this last night with someone. People don't understand. These young people don't understand. Like the first time I saw spring mix was in the late 90s at Earl's. And before that, I had never seen purple leaves. All I knew
right. Yeah,
and I
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you couldn't it was a marketing thing that like didn't exist in the 80s. Like that
in the 80s you had iceberg lettuce, romaine lettuce, maybe like some kinds of cabbage, like, and maybe some endive or something like that.
Whoa.
Radicchio did not exist in the 80s. Or like not in suburban North America. Yeah, you couldn't buy it probably in North America. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And so, and this is the perfect example of like how things have changed. Like to us, we look at, oh yeah, it's mescaline, it's spring mix, it's whatever. But like, and to be fair, like it does look like there's much more interesting varieties in here than what you would get at a grocery store salad mix right now. But
yeah.
But yes, it does. That's where my mind immediately goes, like, oh yeah, it's like spring mix.
Right. Which seems very uninventive, right? So I would definitely wouldn't be doing that you know, on a plate like this for a restaurant or for the Culinary Olympics. I would just like, there's a few things like that in this dish where I feel like for instance, the salmon itself, the way that it's cured is like very, it's like a Gravlax cure basically, right? Mm-hmm. It says marinated, but really it's like cured with salt and brown sugar and allspice, which is like
not as aggressively as Gravlax, like the salt quantity and the period of time that it sits with the marinade is only, I think it's only a day or two,
16 hours or something in the recipe, and Gravlax would be like a few days.
But you're right.
And so I think that like and that I think when you're thinking about how to like cure salmon in this way or do a quick cure on it or something in the 90s, you're like, oh yeah, Gravlax, that's like really interesting. I feel like it's kind of been you know, like used a lot and people are more aware of it now. It doesn't seem nearly as sort of like exotic or as interesting an idea as it would have been in the 90s. And so I would probably veer away from that in terms of The Cure. And then my overall take would just be to sort of like clean things up a little bit flavor-wise, like just focus on a few flavors. So, you know, I would just choose one kind of greens, maybe. I'm not sure what I would do, but like, you know, just one kind of greens that's going to bring a very specific flavor to the dish that I want to highlight or something. The salad has a lemon vinaigrette on it. And I think obviously like lemon goes really well with salmon. And so something else maybe that plays really, like there is dill in the dish also, but like maybe I would focus more on having that dill flavor be very prominent rather than just have it be sort of like there as like, you know, a little bit of herb garnish and a little bit of the, you know, flavor component. I would just like maybe make that like something that's much more prevalent, try and highlight the flavor of the dill rather than, you know, or if you needed something, because then dill is like really what's the word, like delicate. So if you needed some greens that were a little more hearty or something like that, just pick something that has a personality that and a flavor that's going to go with the other components on the dish, but really try to highlight that flavor. Like there's in the lemon dressing, and I would probably change this too, but like the lemon dressing seems like an emulsified vinaigrette, and it uses like all of the regular traditional components that you would use to like emulsify a vinaigrette. So it has mustard in it. But I would probably not emulsify it with mustard, you know, if I wanted to have it be a really lemony flavor, or if I wanted to have a really mustardy flavor, then I might, you know, use a little bit of lemon, but mostly mustard, but then maybe use mustard greens or something like that as well. You know, and so I would probably just refine those aspects of it a little bit, like not have like the mustard and the dill just sort of like be these components, but potentially have them be like larger flavor components of the dish and try and sort of highlight how they work together or something like that. And so I probably wouldn't cure the salmon with brown sugar. Like, you know, I know it's traditional and it's in a lot of salmon cures and it's in most Gravlax recipes that you find, but like, you know, it has molasses in it, which is, you know, a good flavor, but is it a flavor that you're trying to highlight in this dish, or is it a flavor that's potentially sort of like overpowering some of the other flavors that you are trying to highlight in the dish? And so maybe I would cure it with white sugar. And then if you're, wasn't there also, no, juniper's in the main course, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I thought maybe juniper was in this course as well. But yeah, there are quite a few flavors in here, and I would probably just try to pare down the number of flavors and add additional components that highlight those flavors. Start with a bit of a smaller flavor list and be like, what's something that I can put in the vinaigrette that's going to make it more lemony?
And I think actually that's kind of a trend or like a generational difference, I think, that I noticed quite a bit. So like for the lemon vinaigrette, they've got mustard and shallot and black pepper and all this kind of stuff. And like the lemon, my default lemon vinaigrette is like lemon juice and zest, white wine vinegar, salt, honey, and oil. And depends on the application, what kind of oil I'm using. But and it's just two different styles, right? Like and it's up to the chef to decide which one plays better for the dish. I think it is a kind of generational thing too. Like recipes, ingredient lists have gotten smaller.
Right. Well, and I think that like, you know, it used to, I mean, it's not that, because some of that stuff, some of that flavor simplification is like, you know, closely tied with like Nouvelle or post Nouvelle or whatever you want to call it. But like, I feel like for the most part, like in the 90s, you know, like it was a lot more traditionalist, you know, and especially in North America, it was like Western European, like traditional ideas of how to, you know, make these dishes or make these preparations or whatever. And yeah, like you wouldn't really, it wouldn't necessarily occur to someone to take the shallots out of the vinaigrette to enhance the lemon flavor, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Or the mustard, you know, mustard was what you used to make an emulsified vinaigrette.
Yes.
And so an emulsified vinaigrette therefore was, you know, a component that contained mustard. And there's just like, it wasn't a lot of, you know, there wasn't a lot of sort of like the idea of like questioning that just wasn't as prevalent.
Right.
I feel like,
yeah,
at least in like, you know, my exposure and like, I was not a chef or a cook at this time. So
you certainly weren't like a culinary Olympics champion.
No, certainly not. But like, even when I was like starting my career in earnest, which was more like in the 2000s, there was still, you know, it was starting to become more of a thing to like question the idea of like what would go in your vinaigrette. But like,
right,
it wasn't, you know, it was still like vinaigrettes had mustard in them, and that's just, you know, that's just kind of how it was or whatever, you know? And so, you know, like this, it, maybe even at the time, this did seem like a very flavor forward, like simple presentation for these flavors or whatever, you know, like, and it's just that the thinking has changed so much, but yeah, like in order to modernize it, that's what I would be doing. It's just like focusing on enhancing a few flavors that work well together to really clarify what the idea, what the experience of eating the dish would be.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, that's sort of like, you know, that's the theme for how I would reimagine this whole menu is basically along those lines. Right.
Yeah.
What did you, do you want to tell me what kinds of changes you guys made for the appetizer course when you actually served it?
So I took a similar tact. And like, so for instance, for the salmon, the cure was actually just salt. We didn't use the, allspice and pepper. I wanted, so we have allspice.
Or sugar?
Black pepper, no sugar either. Allspice, black pepper, and pink peppercorn as a garnish on this dish. I decided to just, like, the pink peppercorn was going to be the spice flavor that was going to be on the plate. But the salmon itself, we just rubbed down with 2.25% kosher salt and vacuum sealed it. I mean, for a glimpse into the back, like and then partially freeze it so that it slices very cleanly, sliced it and portioned it onto patty papers. Cause it was a large, we were serving 110 people. So it was a large service. For the crepes, I tried a couple things like putting like a grain soaker in it so that it had a bit of texture and visual appeal. But in the end, we ended up just using a very simple and traditional crepe, similar to what they did here. For the greens mix, we have a cultivator, or what's it called? Urban cultivator at work, like where we can grow microgreens and shoots and stuff. The chef who does the planting there, we had requested some greens from him, and we tried to do ones that were mostly in like the kind of brassica mustardy vibes, like Mizuna and Mosh. I can't remember what, we had some other interesting ones for color. And the dressing for that was the one I just described, like a simple lemon forward, like lemon juice and zest, a little bit of white wine vinegar. And I think our oil, we blended cold pressed and regular canola oil for color.
This is the other thing that I was going to say. I guess cold pressed canola oil wasn't really popularized by then. Maybe probably wasn't even being made in Canada for all I know. It seems like a glaring omission in this, in this, they're using canola oil, but not cold pressed. And you know, again, it does have its own flavor, but you know, it's the kind of flavor that you could say, okay, this is like, you know, I know that they grow canola all over the world, but like, you know, it's like a flavor that from something that is grown widely in Canada that, you know, like, you know, we can say is like something that we produce and use and, you know, and have as.
And you know that the can in canola is for Canada, right? You know this?
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. Canola is like a. It stands for,
I mean, it makes Canada, sense now that you mention it.
Canada oil, low acid, like low uric acid.
Right. Okay.
It's like a, anyways,
that's interesting.
There you go. And so the only part of the original dish that when I did my testing didn't like kind of fell flat for me was that cream, like the cream reduction, right. For two reasons. It didn't, mm-hmm. it didn't have much flavor.
I was going to say something about this as well. Yeah.
And then also it didn't, it just didn't plate tidy. Like the drizzle that they have in the photograph here looks whatever. It has relatively clean edges or whatever. But I wanted something a little bit cleaner for the plating. And so what we ended up doing, and this is like really the only significant departure, is that I made a yogurt gel, and we did like from a squeeze bottle, like dots of this yogurt gel on the salmon. For the presentation, we actually did basically exactly what you see in this picture with the two crepes sandwiching the salmon, the one part right. folded back. We folded it back a little bit farther so you can see more of the salmon. And then the dots of the yogurt gel instead of the cream reduction, and then the pink peppercorns on top of that. So it, in the end, it ended up looking very, very similar to this plate. My one comment though for the sandwiching is that we found it a little bit hard. Like if you made the dish as it appears on this plate, the ratio of crepe to salmon is pretty high. Do you know what I mean?
So we exactly like it's a lot of crepe for the amount of salmon that you get.
Yeah. So we tried to make them as thin as possible, but even then afterwards we found, we're using ring cutters to reduce the size of the crepes to bring the balance there. So the salmon features.
Yeah. And I think like I probably would also like the crepe and the cream are really, they probably in context seemed like kind of haute cuisine or something like that. Mm. But they definitely don't feel that way to me now. Just like normal crepes, like without some kind of way to differentiate them, just seems like something I would never put on a competition plate.
Right.
You know, like it's not really like if it's supposed to highlight the technique of making crepes, like,
right. Yeah.
That's not really a technique that's like, that needs to be highlighted anymore. Like I would do something different with it. Like, and I don't know what that is off the top of my head, but probably I would take a bunch of them and find a way to make them crispy or something, mm-hmm. You know, to add another sort of like textural element to the dish.
Right.
And also to potentially be able to sort of like, give the plating a little bit of verticality. I don't think every plating needs to have verticality, but like having a crepe sandwich on the plate mm-hmm. looks kind of, I don't know.
It, would you it say looks it falls a little flat? Rough.
So sorry. Good. From a real dad, folks.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like this in the end, like it's a tasty plate. It's interesting. It does seem, in terms of the demonstration of technique, it seems not so ambitious, not as ambitious as the chocolate owl. Just kidding. But yeah, anyways, it was tasty and I was happy with what we served.
Yeah, I think like, and it's probably just because of the format of the meal and it being three courses and the main course has to have so many things on it. But like this plate to me seems the most directly translatable to something that's contemporary.
Right. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Like you just like a few tweaks here and there and a few flavor enhancements and maybe a little bit of aesthetic sort of like cleanup and, you know, but basically, you know, it's directly translatable, I feel like.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. Then, were you happy with it in the, where do you guys like you ate it and, oh, did you have to use, so I noticed that like in the recipe, it says that they sprayed the plates with Vegeline before they put the first crepe on the bottom. And I'm assuming that's so that it doesn't stick to the plate and so that it's hard for the person to eat or something like that. Did you guys have to do that or?
No, we didn't. This is maybe a competition thing that I don't quite understand. What I imagine though, so these, in their recipe, they say that they build the, like they go Vegeline and then crepe, salmon crepe, and then they warm the plate up, right? Like they were, it was served warm for service. And so I'm wondering in 1992, how do you warm 120 plates for service? I imagine you're just putting them into an Alto-Sham, like into a warming cabinet.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a risk of the crepe sticking to the plate in that process. And
probably.
So there the Vegeline is essential. So we were able, and the Alto-Sham would be a long process. Like if you're gently warming 120 plates, like it's going to take time. But yeah, we're at least
15 minutes or something like that.
Right. So, but we're able to retherm in a rationale. And so it takes like 3 minutes or whatever. And so there was, there was no, and it has really good moisture control. So,
So no risk of drying out and really no risk of having the plates like, or the crepe, the bottom crepe sort of like get too warm and start sticking to the plate or something like that.
Yeah. So we didn't use that. No. Sorry, Vegeline. Okay. I just assume it's vegetable oil spray, like the kind, like a non-stick
spray. It's just like baking spray. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think it's a brand of baking spray.
Oh, okay.
Comes in like a yellow can. Okay. Yeah. I think if I'm remembering that correctly. So moving on to the main course.
Yeah. So to describe how they did it. So they were working with pheasant and they deboned the bird. They cold smoked the breasts and then did a herb underlay beneath the skin of the basil and rosemary. And then, finished cooking it. And then it's sliced, like very classical, like shingled, like the breast is cut into, I think like 6 rounds or something, and then shingled across the front of the plate. The leg meat from the pheasant, boned and ground, and then made into this interesting, what they called potato lasagna.
Yeah.
And it's layers of grated potato. They don't call it this, but what's effectively a bechamel, sliced cheddar cheese, and the ground pheasant meat. Mm-hmm. And so that's layered, baked, and then cut into squares, like a kind of, it looks like a pavé, and put on the plate. Yeah. The vegetables, they have baby leeks and French baby carrots that are glazed with butter. And they have braised Savoy cabbage in a fairly traditional form. They have a reduction sauce. They call it the glass of pheasant, which has, they called it dried black currants. I'm looking at it and wondering if it's actually dried currants, like the ones that are little grapes, little raisins, because I've never heard of dried black currants. Sorry, do you know what I mean? Like dried black currants.
No, I don't know what you mean.
So what, like, when you go to the store and you buy a bag of currants and they're like the tiny raisins, those are actually made from a kind of grape. They're not made from currants, like black currants or red currants.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's true.
I did not know that.
They're made from a specific kind of grape. And so they are effectively mini raisins, mini grape raisins.
Why did they call them currants then, Alan? This is very confusing.
Do you want to know why?
My whole world has been thrown into upheaval.
Because they,
I do.
The grape variety and the process is from Corinth in Greece.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Cool. Wow.
So I'm looking at the photos.
Thanks for the new info.
Oh, no. Looking at the photos and thinking about what is actually available, I'm quite sure that they would have been using currants.
Dried black currants.
Well,
actual black currants.
I think they're not using actual black currants, but I don't know.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Because I've never seen anywhere dried black currants. Even though that's what they say they're eating. But anyways, and they look quite big for dried black currants to me. But and that's it. Sorry, that's the dish. So.
Okay. Yeah.
One thing that I really like about this, I've been toying with this idea of, so when we, basically, whenever we have meat on the menu, we have trim loss, and we always try and find ways to use that up for cost recovery and sustainability. But usually that the trim finds its way into another dish. Like you have the trim from this pheasant and it ends up in a sausage on another dish. And then you have the difficulty of balancing the amount of protein you're bringing in to feature and the amount of trim that you're producing, like those menu items don't sell at the same rate. And so it's kind of a sticking point. I have this idea though, where I want on each plate for the trim and the feature protein to be on the plate proportionally so that we don't have that problem.
Yeah.
So for instance, like if you have rack of lamb, you trim the lamb down so it's like noisette of lamb, and then the trim becomes merguez sausage or whatever, and you have a little, like smaller portions of rack of lamb and small portions of merguez on the same plate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they're doing here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like that's, yeah, that honestly doesn't feel like a sort of like foreign technique or idea to me. Like that's definitely something that I've encountered and definitely something that I've tried to incorporate into menus like previously, because it works a lot better in terms of being able to control the amount of trim that you're getting rid of for a specific dish, because you're going to sell the same amount of that dish. So as long as proportionally you put it on the dish in the correct proportion, then, you know, you're going to, you're not going to have a whole lot left over, which is great. Okay. You want to hear my approach?
Yeah.
I mean, the dish seems like well conceived. I don't think that I would want to use like the glass as a sauce. And that's just like a more of like, that's like a modernism kind of thing.
Okay.
Also, there's like the, or if I was going to use the glass as a sauce, I would probably try to maybe do something different with it. Not just have it be like, you know, a butter mounted glass and then that's the sauce for the plate. I would maybe, you know, make the glass, but then try and incorporate that flavor into a different sauce or something like that. I don't know, just to, so that it's, because I don't know, man, it's tough. Like glass is delicious, but then it also becomes very gloopy. It's hard to actually get it. Like you can see like in the picture of the plating of this dish that they have it underneath the pheasant, right?
Yeah.
Underneath the pheasant breast. And so, you know, then, which like, you know, for the 90s, that's just how you plate things, right? Like, but the, you know, like to make the plating look nice, they're not like drizzling any of the sauce over the pheasant. So you have to take your piece of pheasant and like scoop up some sauce from the bottom of the plate.
Right.
Which like, I don't know. I just feel like there's something else that I could do. Like, I don't know. I don't want to like, you know, like, I'm not necessarily all about strictly modernist ideas, but yeah, like maybe do something with the consistency of the sauce so that you could put it on top of the pheasant in a clean looking way or something like that.
Yeah.
Also like somewhat hilariously, this plate incorporates the like old food trope of putting fruit with game.
Yes.
Which, yeah, you know, like it wouldn't be a game plate unless there was like the black currants and the sauce for some reason. Like there's just, you can't serve game without putting fruit with it. Like it would just be, you would be laughed out of the competition or something. I don't know. It's so I don't know if I would necessarily feel compelled to have the currants be a component in this plate. But if you had like really amazing currants and you wanted to show them off at the pheasant, okay, yeah, like I can see it. They probably go nicely together, right. But
yeah,
I just wouldn't necessarily feel compelled to subscribe to that trope. Another thing that I noticed is that they don't, there's no, and maybe this is just like an omission, and maybe in reality they did this, but there's no indication that they brine the pheasant breasts in any way.
Right.
And I don't know, that seems, I don't know, seems like a lost opportunity.
Yeah, I wonder.
I would probably brine the breasts.
I don't know if that was a common technique back then. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. And but like I know that, like I know that a lot of techniques that I learned in my early career were basically like forged in the like crucible of 90s haute cuisine. And like definitely when I, in my early career, brining was like a huge deal. It was like, you know, and it was also starting to make its way, like in the 90s, it was already starting to make its way out into like home cooking. Like it showed up on like quite a few like cooking shows in the late 90s and stuff, like, oh, you should brine your turkey and stuff like that.
Right.
So
yeah.
So I don't think that it, like, I'm pretty sure that it was like relatively well known as a technique, and I'm a little bit surprised that there's no mention of it here, but maybe they actually did brine the breasts and they just don't mention it or something. I don't know. And then, yeah, like the potato lasagna to me, or pavé, seems a little bit, yeah, like again, like too many ingredients, a little flavor confused. Like
how so?
There's, well, there are, so there's the leg meat from the pheasant. Oh, also, I've never cooked with pheasant before. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have a relatively good understanding of how I would approach it, but yeah, like just keep in mind that I've never cooked pheasant before. Okay. So,
yeah.
So you've got the leg meat.
Sorry. You're talking about the confusing ingredients. I was like, oh, I can't remember the ingredients list. I don't think it was confusing. And I glance at it, and the very first where my eyes go, this is what I read: orange zest, yeah, cheddar cheese.
Yeah, yeah. So there's exactly. So there's pheasant leg meat. There's potatoes. No indication of what variety of potatoes, which I find a little bit weird. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe they knew what variety they were going to use, but they just didn't feel like listing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, garlic and shallots. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think, you know, like having those aromatics in here doesn't really confuse the flavor, because like for a, you know, like for a potato dish, you like,
yeah,
it would seem weirdly absent, I think, if you didn't have mm-hmm. some kind of those types of aromatics in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also leeks, which is a little weird because like they don't actually describe how they cook the vegetables in this documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least not that I could see. And then but in the recipe for the potato lasagna, they tell you to chop up the leeks and put them in, but then when you look at the picture of the plate, the baby leeks are obviously like treated individually and used as a vegetable on the plate.
Right.
So I don't know if there's leeks in the potato recipe and they're different from the baby leeks that they put on the plate, but I found that a little bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so there's garlic, shallot, leeks, and then orange, thyme, cheddar cheese, like all of those things. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. like, which one, you know, right. What, and what's, so like the orange and maybe, yeah, probably like the orange is there because it's fruit and it plays well with the game or something. Like,
yeah, maybe
it's,
yeah,
you know, like, or, you know, like, and it's with the leg meat. So maybe it's like a riff on like the orange, or like
L'orange
the pairing of like orange and duck or yeah, something like that. Like,
yeah,
yeah, not quite sure. Why the orange is there necessarily, but I'm assuming it's to pair with the leg meat that's in this. And then there's thyme and there's cheddar cheese and like all of these things. Like, yeah, it just seems like, I'm sure it's tasty, but it doesn't really seem like it's highlighting one thing mm-hmm. or has like a cohesive sort of like story about what it's supposed to taste like or what the texture is supposed to be like.
I don't know.
It's just sort of somebody's opinion of like what things will go together.
Right.
You know?
With the exception of cheddar cheese, like all those things sound like something I would put into duck confit or something, like thyme, orange,
yeah,
garlic. That sounds nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear you. Like all of those flavors. I don't know if I would. Yeah. But then like if I was making a potato pavé, like the thyme and all of the like the garlic and shallots and the cheese would all work. Mm-hmm. But probably not the orange.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So yeah, I don't know. It's kind of, I don't know. Anyway, I would probably try to just pare down the flavor complexity,
right,
in the potato lasagna. I've never actually seen like a potato pavé with like stuffed with a meat or like a sausage of any kind.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Way to reuse the trim, and yeah, I think it's a cool idea. In the recipe there, so, and then there's like you said, there's like what's ostensibly a bechamel.
Mm-hmm. They call it
in the recipe, they refer to it, yeah, they refer to it as a royale. Mm-hmm. And a royale is like, I mean, it's like, well, it's more like an egg custard,
right,
than it is like a bechamel.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I guess like sounds nice. Also sounds kind of delicate for something to go inside like this like kind of rustic potato dish. Seems just like it might get lost, or the texture of it might not be very noticeable or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then also with the royale, like choosing to use a royale as that component instead of something like a more traditional bechamel seems a little bit risky to me, because I would think that you would run the risk of like kind of scrambling the custard.
Right.
Baking, yeah, it in this potato situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, like maybe that's part of the technique, is to like make this potato lasagna and have this like beautiful royale custard inside it, and it doesn't get scrambled somehow.
Right. Yeah.
and it has like this very beautiful texture. And if you're, if that's a part of the technique and they have a way of doing that, then that seems like a really cool idea, but it also seems quite delicate for something that you're probably going to have to mash through with your fork. Like, you know, and then I would also be concerned that like the cheddar cheese would split.
Oh, okay. You mean, and just like get greasy? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Get greasy.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, maybe there's enough starch in there with the potato and everything that that doesn't happen or something. And so maybe that's fine. But yeah, like with the Royale and with the cheddar cheese, I'm just kind of like, you know, like how are we going to make this work so that it's not greasy and doesn't curdle or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I find those components slightly worrisome, and I just don't know. Like I feel like I would probably separate them out somehow and have them as separate components, like maybe together with the potato on the plate, but like have the Royale be a topping for the potato or something like that. I'm not quite sure. Just to sort of like avoid that. And then something that I found pretty funny in the documentation is that they use the word seasonable quite a bit
instead of seasonal.
Yeah, which like is a real word, and it means the, it means what they use it, like it means the right thing for the context that they use it in. Like it means basically the same thing as seasonal. But for some reason, and I think it was in common usage in the 90s.
Like, is that right? Yeah.
I remember hearing the word seasonable,
yeah,
you know, in relation to food sometimes, but now it seems so foreign. Like it's, it seems like it's not even a word anymore.
I did not pick up on that, but yeah, I think I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So it, there's, they used it to describe the vegetables on this main course plate. Right. They said it comes with seasonable vegetables. Which now, you know, because the word seasonal is in more common usage, the word seasonable
makes it sort sound of like
sounds
it's
like it's something that's able to be seasoned. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Really hilarious. But they also use it to describe the pricing, which, you know, isn't really. You know, they describe the price of some of the things that they, because they have a price list for all of these dishes, and or like a costing list for all of these dishes, and they describe the pricing of some of the ingredients that they have to get as seasonable, like whatever the seasonable pricing is, is what the cost will be, which I found kind of fun. But yeah, so they, you know, they have seasonable vegetables on this plate, so and the yeah, like you said, it's carrots and baby leeks and Savoy cabbage, which in Canada, those vegetables kind of all are from different seasons.
You think? No, I disagree. Well, sorry, it's certainly baby leeks. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, baby leeks are definitely from the spring.
Yeah.
The carrots and the Savoy cabbage you can have at the same time.
Right.
For sure. Like the carrots, but the carrots, like usually you're getting some like throughout the summer. Like you plant them early and they grow pretty quickly. Like you usually have carrots by midsummer that are a reasonable size. Or at least late summer. But then Savoy cabbage is probably not something that you're really going to be harvesting until like September. So yeah, I don't know.
I mean, the thing is for like asparagus, which is a perennial vegetable, yes, it grows in the spring, and then after the spring it can't return to its stock, to its baby stock form. But leeks, like you can sow leeks in August and have baby leeks in September.
Yeah.
Or sorry, in October.
I mean. No, yeah, that's yeah. Totally. I mean, totally agree. You can have these all fresh grown at the same time.
And it's, they did. It's possible. Because we have the picture to prove it.
Right. But, yeah, yeah. But are they, like, I don't know. It just makes me question, like, are they, you know, where are they procuring them all from? Like, are they, you know, like, are they using actually Canadian vegetables?
No, no, certainly not. Wondering. They're using German vegetables.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And then, so, how does that work? Like, do they... You know, are they getting them from a German farmer? Are they requesting that they be planted? You know, like, or are they just going to, you know, like I would, a market? Or
I would think that, like, we're not used to seeing them, but I would imagine that in maybe in culinary procurement in Europe, they were a common item, baby leeks. Like just like French carrots.
Right.
Like we don't really see them in grocery stores, but like those carrots that you see there that are like pared down and so clean and everything, like those you can just buy them through any food distributor now.
Right.
So I don't know about the bleaks there.
Yeah. Anyways, it's just like having this vegetable medley in and of itself is just like, you know, a very kind of like 90s situation, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like we're going to have vegetables on the plate. There's no, like, I don't know. It doesn't really feel to me like what's going to make this pheasant. Yeah.
It's
pheasanty.
It's perfunctory.
You know,
right?
Like
the perfunctory.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of, you know, and there wasn't really like, I feel like, it just wasn't something that was like necessary to think about. You knew that you were going to have vegetables on your plate and you knew that you wanted them to be some nice vegetables, and what they were and what their story behind why they belonged on the plate was just not really something that bore as much like sort of like necessity to like have thought put into it. It was just like, what good vegetables can we get and how can we make them taste nice? You know, like not how are they going to play off the flavors that we have in the potato lasagna and the pheasant and things like that. It's just like, we need vegetables. What can we get?
I will say pheasant and cabbage is extreme. Like it's very classical. And there's actually like classical French dishes like chou farci, like stuffed cabbage is classically mm-hmm. made with pheasant. So that one to me rings very, very traditional. The leeks and carrots.
I'm shocked to hear that you know the classical pairings for cabbage, yeah. Alan. I'm shocked. Yeah.
The joke is that I eat a lot of cabbage. That's the joke.
The joke is that you love cabbage and that you love to work with it. And you, yeah.
Okay, so Shale's version of this dish. We've heard a lot about what you're not going to do.
I knew we were going to wind up in this place.
What does your dish look like? What does the pheasant look like?
Yeah, so I think that I would still do the potato lasagna, but that I would probably just omit the orange flavor altogether. Mm. And then I might break out the Royale and the cheddar cheese to be separate components, maybe, that I could use to garnish the potato part of the dish. Mm-hmm. And the pheasant breast, I would probably treat in a similar way. Like I might even still shingle it, like cut it on a bias like it is and shingle it. I'm not really sure if you can make pheasant skin crispy or as crispy as the, but I might try to do something with that. Like I might, and like they've stuffed herbs and things under the pheasant skin mm-hmm. for flavor here. Mm-hmm. Which seems like a great idea to me. And I, you know, might still be like the kind of thing that I would want to do, but I might also want to remove the pheasant skin and make it crispy or something. Mm-hmm. And then figure out a way to, like I said, I would still want to use the stock or like in a sauce. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe I would still turn it into demi-glace, but then figure out a different maybe texture for it so that I could cleanly put it on top of the pheasant. Mm-hmm. And then with the vegetables, I'd probably pick one and make it into a component that, you know, that was like something that was going to strengthen the flavors of the dish. And, you know, you say Savoy cabbage and pheasant is a classical pairing. That sounds great to me. Mm-hmm. I also love Savoy cabbage. That would be the one that I would be most inclined to use probably. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not quite sure what I would do with it, but I would probably try to find, you know, a way to highlight the cabbage umami types of flavors with it, but still have it have like its crinkly Savoy cabbage texture in some way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm not quite sure what I would do with it, but I might wrap something in a Savoy cabbage leaf or something that. Yeah. Maybe
that would be a good nod to that stuffed cabbage dish. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe like I wouldn't want to I still like the idea of putting the leg meat in the potato lasagna, mm-hmm. but maybe if there was additional leg meat, or maybe you could make an additional out of part of the breast and part of the leg or something, you could make an additional farce and, mm-hmm. and have it inside the stuffed inside the Savoy cabbage leaf and have that like kind of crinkly Savoy cabbage outside so that you have this sort of like stuffed Savoy cabbage leaf or something.
I like that. I don't know. Some halubs tea on there.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, so I guess that's sort of like more my what my vision would be, and then I would try to have a little bit more white space on the plate, obviously, not just have everything sort of clumped together like right. starch veg. Yeah. You know, like the plating of this dish is not very. I mean, it looks nice for a 90s style plate with starch veg and protein on it.
Yeah.
Like it looks pretty clean in that context, but I, you know, like it definitely doesn't look very modern, and there's a lot that you could do to improve the plating, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So like, I don't know. I guess that's sort of my take.
Cool.
What was you guys' take?
So this was, again, we initially set out to recreate the plate exactly, but this one ended up looking very different, fairly different than the original. So first off,
cool.
is extremely hard, if not impossible, to get pheasant in Alberta right now.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too.
I think this is basically just hearsay. I think one of the larger producers that was supplying restaurants in Alberta went out of business or stopped operating. Someone, I meant to look into this. Someone told me that maybe avian flu had something to do with this as well, that maybe
really?
Flocks had to be culled, but we didn't have access to pheasant. It's and actually wild game has stopped, like, to bring in things like quail and squab and stuff. You have to buy like pallets from them now. They don't keep it on hand like they used to.
Wow, so really?
What we had access to was Cornish game hen.
Okay.
So not exactly the same thing, but a good substitute.
Yeah, a relatively good substitute, I would say.
It's only available as whole birds, obviously. I don't know. Yep. Maybe that's not obvious. So...
Well, which is what you want theoretically for making this dish, because you want to use the legs and then you want to use the carcasses and to make the glass and
And so with each guest getting one Cornish game hen breast, and we're serving 120 people, we need 60 Cornish game hens that all need to be completely boned out. So that was a lot of work. But the breasts we brined. I was thinking about that herb underlay. And so they used basil and rosemary. To me, basil, like when you cook fresh basil, it just like...
It's just going to wilt and get weird.
Yeah, and kind of loses a lot of its flavor. So omitted the basil. I like rosemary in this dish, but I didn't do any herbs under the skin. It was mostly a time thing. It was just like so much work to process these birds. We didn't do it. So the breast was brined.
Yes, that's why you weren't on the Olympic team.
Exactly. We did put rosemary and juniper in the brine. Looking at their process again, they actually did hot smoke the pheasant to medium rare and then finished roasting it well in the oven. What we did though was after the brine, the breast came out, patted dry, dried overnight, cold smoked. And then because we were working with such small pieces of meat, and such a tight timeline for service, we did end up sous vide-ing them or cooking them sous vide.
Okay. Yeah.
And then they were reverse seared after that. So, and for the carving of.
Right. And so that probably didn't really give you much opportunity to do much in terms of like really honing in on a texture for the skin or something.
That's
like
right.
That,
it looked nice. It had great color and it browned well, but it was not. And it was fairly well rendered, but it wasn't crispy. No.
Yeah.
For the sauce, we had all the bones from the carcasses. They were roasted to make brown game hen stock. And we made a very traditional red wine and game hen reduction mounted with butter. For the currant component, like I mentioned, we looked into it and we're pretty sure that dried black currants are not a thing. But so what we ended up doing, and this is where we really start to get off into the more contemporary presentation of this plate. The only blackcurrant product we had access to was blackcurrant puree, like the boiron, like pastry stuff. So we made a fluid gel with that. And instead of having dried black currants in a reduction sauce. We had a reduction sauce and a separate sauce of this gel of black currant.
Yeah, which I think is better. Like, that's a better idea.
It was it was tasty. And I mean, it was really, and it presented really well. And so now that we're getting off into the contemporary vein for carving the pheasant breast, the game hen breast, we did just like the lengthwise split in half.
Sliced down the middle.
And the part of it was a supreme. So it still had the cleaned drumette bone on it.
Drumette, yeah.
One of the half with the drumette bone was put cut side down on the plate. So the bone was vertical. And then the other one was put cut side up, kind of leaning up against it.
Right.
For the lasagna, first off, my coworker suggested that people attending the dinner, when they see lasagna on the menu and they don't get noodles, that they would be disappointed or confused or upset.
Yeah.
So he suggested, I think it was a really good idea. We changed the language. So it's potato moussaka. Because then it's like layered potatoes and ground meat, and people are a little bit more familiar with that. But
yeah, that makes sense.
I had the exact, you're right. So I said it was basically a bechamel that they use, but no, you're right. It's a royale. It's a custard. I had the exact same reservations as you did about the ease of cutting and cleanliness of plating with what they had described in the recipe package. The plate looks nice and tidy, like when they did it, obviously. I wasn't sure if I could execute that. So the Royale.
Well, and also, like, I just wonder if, like, because it looks so tidy, it makes me think that there's just a very small amount of this, like, Royale in it or something, which then I'm kind of like, well, then why is it there? You know, like, I just feel like you're not even going to notice it, like, texturally or something. And I could be wrong. Like, maybe there is, like, a really significant layer of it and they have, like, a really good way of cutting it or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I would love to. We can get to this, but like, was there anyone at the dinner who was on this team?
Yes, the entire.
And did you get to talk to them?
One member of the team is deceased. That's actually Maurice O'Flynn. I don't know. I don't know if you know Ryan O'Flynn, his father. Do you know Ryan?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't really know Ryan very well, but I know who he is. Yeah, he's a chef in the city.
His father, Maurice, was the manager of this team, and he died in 2016. Cool. But all the other team members were, except for one. All the other ones were there.
Cool. And did you have a chance to talk to them at all about it, or just like sort
not
of,
really,
hey, how's it going? Oh, glad you could come.
I was in the kitchen, and this was a big reunion for these folks. So I was not, I was not a part of it. It'd be interesting though. Yeah. I would love to, I'm sure we could think
about it. Yeah.
I'd
love to hear their
questions.
Takes on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, the Royale became bechamel.
Okay.
And bechamel that was like cooked and then chilled down, and we whisked egg yolks into it so that when it so that it will set up in the moussaka. I don't know if you noticed this, but the potato layers in their version, the potatoes were grated.
I noticed it in the recipe, but when I looked at it on the picture, it doesn't look like they're grated.
Yeah.
In the picture, it looks like they're just sliced like a regular potato pavé, but it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah.
It's a small picture.
So we did sliced potatoes like a pavé because I thought that would just give better structure. And then we layered, sliced potato, the pheasant leg meat. We cooked it to get a bit of color on it and then added just minced onion, garlic, the rosemary that was in the pheasant we put into the moussaka, small amount of tomato paste. And I think that was it actually. So the layers ended up being the sliced potato, the ground pheasant, the bechamel with egg yolk. We actually happened to have a cheddar cheese that was made at Nate, so grated cheddar.
Right.
And then that was repeated. The top layer was just more bechamel, like a gratin bechamel and grated cheddar. We baked that, and then like a pavé, we weighed it down. We compressed it during cooling and refrigerated it overnight before slicing. It had great texture. It sliced very cleanly. Besides the actual cutting, I was worried that once it was hot, like you would have the kind of like tectonic plate shifting going with the different layers, but it was very cohesive. And actually, I think it would be a really fun idea, like for a contemporary menu item to do like a small portion of rack of lamb with a miniature freestanding moussaka with some of the trim. Yeah. I think that could be really fun.
So did you have the orange in there as well?
No. So it was just really onion, garlic, rosemary, tomato paste. Yeah. In the meat.
And Right. And then you didn't have any problem with the cheddar cheese like separating or getting oily or anything like that? You didn't notice anything like
that? No, like it was sprinkled onto the bechamel.
So there was only one layer of cheddar cheese and that was on top? Or, I see what you mean. Like, it probably sort of became a mornay as it cooked.
Sort of, yeah, basically.
Yeah,
okay. A cheddar mornay, right.
Yeah.
And kind of spreading the bechamel on top of the ground meat. Like, it still looked like distinct layers, but it just, like, kind of made sure that the meat wasn't crumbly and falling out the side of the portions.
Right.
Yeah. It worked well.
Yeah, so the bechamel is there, or like the royale would be there to sort of like hold the meat together in place. Like, you don't have a, like, so the meat is like sort of sprinkled in chunks, not like a full layer or something.
Ours was like, it was ground and cooked. Like, it had the consistency of taco meat, basically.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. It seemed to me that in this recipe that they made like sort of like a, it seemed more to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that they used the leg meat basically raw and then packed it as a layer. Is that, am I crazy?
That's an interesting point.
It seemed like maybe they hot smoked the entire birds to medium rare. Then they took the leg meat, then they took the legs and breasts off. So that also the carcasses were smoked, and then the leg meat, while it was medium rare, so like partially cooked, then they turned that into basically a sausage and then used it to cover an entire layer in the potato lasagna instead of like cooking it and having it be like ground, like, or cooked like little bits of sausage and sprinkling it in. I'm not positive.
No. Okay. I'm looking at it right now. So the first step in the dealing with the pheasant is take the legs and backs off. So only the breasts are going into the smoker, but you're right that the leg meat was ground but not pre-cooked. It was put raw into
the potato lasagna.
Anyways, yeah, I like the idea and it turned out well.
Yeah,
for the veggies,
cool.
We weren't
probably
able,
couldn't get baby leeks.
Exactly, yeah. And so I did some tests where I tried like using the bases of green onions to get the same visual look. But what we ended up just doing a little round of fondant leek. So like leeks cut into rounds, kind of like butter poached and then seared. We did the French carrots and we did cabbage, but we did braised red cabbage just for color and it's traditional and yeah.
And you love it.
And I like making it. Yeah. some departures and the plating was, like I mentioned, like with the carving of the bird and there was lots of white space and it was much more contemporary. Yeah.
Yeah. Contemporary looking. Yeah. It wouldn't take much to like take everything that's on this plate and plate it in a way that looks more contemporary.
Oh, yeah.
Even without changing some of the ingredients or whatever. So
yeah.
And it definitely it looks pretty, like the picture of the plate looks pretty contemporary for the 90s. Yep. Like it looks nice and clean.
Contemporaneous with the 90s. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. That makes more sense. Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I already said enough bad things about the dessert, so I think maybe we're done.
one interesting thing that changed about the dessert that I thought was great. So they have this wild rice croquant, which is kind of like, it's like wild cooked wild rice folded into a caramel kind of. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And one,
like a hard caramel.
Yeah. And one interesting change that the pastry chef instructor at Nate made was that he puffed the wild rice. Like he fried the wild rice, so it puffed up just to give it a bit more texture. So I thought that was smart.
Yeah. Was that not? Oh, I think when I read it on this menu, I assumed that they had puffed the wild rice because I was like, yeah, but I guess not.
The ingredients list just says wild rice cooked. So that makes me think that it's just boiled.
That it's just boiled. Yeah that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely puffed is a way better idea for that. Although, I like the, when I read this recipe, I like the croquant idea. Like, I mean, it seems very simple, but at the same time, it seems like something that I like. I've used sugar glass for a lot of things and like caramel glass for a lot of things, but I haven't really like done other things with it, incorporated other ingredients or components into it, or like tried to give it different textures and things like that. So it's sort of like reading that and then reading about, because I didn't know what a croquant was when I read this. And so I looked it up and then that kind of really sparked my imagination for a bunch of different stuff that you could do. And, you know, like this obviously shows like, you know, how they have the croquant on the plate. It's like a cylinder, and then they have like the this like mousse inside of it, I guess.
Yeah, like rhubarb butter, I think they called it.
Yeah, rhubarb butter. Yeah, that like that all is like showing like really, you know, really solid like sugar work techniques and things like that. And there are some like and like the way that like the knife work is for like the other garnishes that are on this plate and stuff, I think, you know, shows a lot of technique. I just had, I don't know, I had a lot of issues trying to wrap my head around the owl.
Yes.
And it's mostly just the aesthetic look of the owl. I just think it looks like really, I don't know.
I get it.
Not very professional.
You know what this plate is missing though?
What?
A Cape gooseberry.
How is it not on there? You're right. Oh my God. It's a miracle that there's not. It must have been 1993, must have been the year of the Cape gooseberry or something, man. Like this.
Yeah.
It's shocking that there's not a Cape gooseberry on here. One thing that I love that's on here too is like this triangular like presentation of like a little bit of like, I don't know, it looks like two sauces. So maybe it's like a strawberry coulis or a rhubarb coulis or something. And then they have like,
I think it's blackberry coulis. It's
blackberry coulis. Okay. Yeah. But, and then it looks like it's surrounded by something else. Is it balsamic?
Oh, I just assumed it was chocolate, like lines of chocolate that they can flood with the blackberry coulis.
Yeah. With, yeah. Yeah. It's very 90s looking aesthetically. Yeah. I would love to be able to put a picture of this dessert plate on our Instagram.
Sure. So. Yeah. And I have pictures of the plates that we serve too, I think.
Oh, great. Yeah.
For the awesome. The outro to this episode, can you play Jump by Criss Cross or you have to get the rights or something?
I don't know. I can probably play 10 seconds of it. Let's find out.
So I liked the song Jump when I was seven. But my friends and I were kind of like disagreed on whether or not it was cool to wear your clothes backwards. Like Criss Cross. But
which side were you on?
Well, okay, I'll tell you. One morning I went to my friend Jamie Cole's house and he answered the door and his clothes were on backwards. And I was like, did you crisscross your clothes? And you could tell he was kind of embarrassed because I didn't think it was cool. And so he said, I woke up and I got dressed in the dark. So I just happened to put them on back. But then he went to the bathroom and changed his clothes so they weren't crisscrossed anymore.
Oh man, poor guy. Yeah. Don't try to compare us to another bad little fad. I'm the Mac and I'm bad. Give me something that you never had. I make you bump, wiggle and shake your rump. Cause I be kicking up like, but that makes you wanna jump. How high, real high, cause I'm just so fly. A young, lovable, huggable type of guy. And everything is to the back with a little slack. Cause inside out is wiggle, 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 whack.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.